We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Want to put your baseball skills to the test? Then get ready to show your stuff with MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run. The official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Sign up for free for a chance to play your way to the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 World Series. Visit pitchhitrun.com today.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Living Better in San Diego, a public service presentation of the Entercom San Diego radio stations. I'm Amber Rainey. The coronavirus pandemic has forced millions out of work and many into isolation. And while social distancing isn't easy for anyone, it is hitting one group particularly hard. People who are recovering from a substance abuse disorder are finding it difficult to maintain sobriety, and many of them are relapsing during COVID-19. And that's why I asked Dr. Fadi Nicholas, Chief Medical Officer of Sharp Behavioral Health Services, to join the show today. For years now, Sharp Healthcare and Sharp Mesa Vista Hospital, they've been a source of hope for San Diegans facing drug and alcohol addiction. Their highly trained medical team is dedicated to guiding its patients and their loved ones towards recovery and a break free from the addiction cycle. And joining us right now is Dr. Nicholas. Hello.
Hi.
Now, for those who aren't really familiar with Sharp Mesa Vista Hospital, how about you give us a little background on what services you provide?
Sure. At Sharp Mesa Vista, we have basically the whole continuum of care. We have inpatient services, both for psychiatric and substance abuse treatment. We also have 19 intensive outpatient programs between us and our sister hospital, Sharp McDonald Center, which is a substance abuse program. And in these outpatient programs, we have different types of services we provide. Some ranges from child and adolescent services all the way to geriatric services. We have substance abuse services. We have eating disorder services. We have cognitive behavioral therapy and dialectical behavioral therapy. So specialized programs and programs for different type of population.
And where are you located?
We are in the Kearny Mesa area, but we also have a couple of satellites, one in East County and one in Mid-City. And McDonald Center is basically a mile away from us, which is our substance abuse small hospital.
And that's inpatient, correct?
We also have inpatient and outpatient there.
Oh, okay. You do both.
Yeah.
All right. And how long have you been working for Sharp?
I've been with Sharp for 15 years, but I've been in my position for the last year and a half.
And your position is the Chief Medical Officer. What other titles have you held while working at Sharp?
I was the program director, medical director for the dual diagnosis program, and I was the medical director of one of the inpatient units at the hospital, and I was chief of staff at some point.
Oh, nice. Very nice. And dual diagnosis, can you explain what that is?
Sure. So patients who have dual diagnosis disorders, meaning they're dealing with substance abuse issues and psychiatric issues. It could be something like depression and anxiety, and it could be as severe as bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. And the difficulty in treating these disorders that happen together is it's sometimes difficult to tell which one is causing the other. So you basically have to treat both at the same time.
Oftentimes they do go hand in hand, right?
Exactly.
I know with COVID-19, a lot of places have been shut down or closed right now. Are your outpatient services currently open?
Yes, we actually never closed. We had to switch a big part of our programs to online services, but we never closed completely. And currently we have some programs, for example, the child and adolescent programs, they do completely provide services in person. And we have programs for the geriatric patients, for example, that is almost completely via telepsych. And other programs have a mixture of both. So we have some people who come in person and some people who are remotely connected to the therapist.
So today I wanted to specifically talk to you about mental health and addiction with a focus on relapse during the COVID-19 pandemic. It's been reported that many, many people in recovery are having a hard time with the isolation of having to be home, getting laid off or furloughed, and the relapse rate has gone up. Have you noticed that on your end?
Yes, we definitely have received a lot of calls, a lot more than usual, people wanting services to detox or receive rehabilitation in our facilities, in our programs. And unfortunately, it makes a lot of sense because a lot of people, like you mentioned, their life got affected by the pandemic directly or indirectly.
I'm in recovery myself for alcohol.
Oh, great.
And when everything closed down, the AA meetings closed down as well.
Exactly.
So it was switched over to Zoom AA meetings. And I know for me, that was hard because it's really not the same. You're not getting in-person contact with, you know, other people in recovery. And it did affect my recovery, actually. After a few months of being sober, I relapsed. Mm-hmm. I am sober now. Thank you.
Good.
I sought treatment. But yeah, I thought it was interesting the fact that AA meetings were closed down, yet liquor stores were deemed essential.
Were considered essential.
Right.
Yeah, which is bizarre.
Yeah, it doesn't make much sense. So for anyone who is, you know, thinking they might have an issue with drugs or alcohol, can you kind of go through the process of what do you do? Who do you call?
Sure.
Where do you go?
So let's first start from the initial part. During this difficult crisis, this could be probably the worst global crisis for most adults living right now.
Absolutely.
Many of us were not around in World War II. And since World War II and maybe Vietnam, this is basically the biggest crisis we're going through, not just the U.S., the world, basically. So there are a myriad of emotions happening at the same time. Initially, we had a lot of fear, loss of control. You see people rushing to try to control as much as just toilet papers. You know, anything they can control, they want to control because it was so uncertain. And then we kind of went through a grief process where we're locked up in our houses, where our lives were disrupted. And we went through a lot of anxiety and uncertainty, our jobs, our financial situations. People lost their houses, their health insurance. But now we're kind of getting into a phase where some people are going through denial phase and then pretending that everything is fine and back to normal, or they're going through this anger phase. And people are dealing with it in different ways. So people tend to kind of regress to unhealthy habits that they used in the past. So if you're used to isolate, you isolate more. If you're used to overeat, you overeat more. If you oversleep or undersleep, you kind of do the same. And same thing for people who have issues with substances or gambling or any type of addiction, video game addiction. We're seeing people kind of regressing to these type of behaviors. And again, that's in a way a normal reaction. So the goal is really to increase people's resilience. How do you kind of get back to the resources that you used to do and have when we were in a better spot? So for you, for example, it was going to meetings, or for other people, it might be, I don't know, self-care and increase exercise. So there are practical things we can all do, and there are emotional and psychological things we can all do. So we can go into detail if you'd like me to.
Yeah, I would like to I would like for you to explain to people, okay, I think I have a problem. I want to get help. Who do I call?
So from a practical perspective, you can certainly call. We have several programs in town. You can call our hospital or you call any of the other hospitals and see what available services. And what they will do is they will have a phone conversation with you and try to kind of see where you're at in your addiction or in your mental health problem, and they'll kind of try to match you to the right level. Not everybody is going to need to come into the hospital to detox. Some people might can manage with an outpatient detox or straight in one of our IOPs. Or they might say, no, we think you can just go back to your AA meetings and seek resources. So, you know, a phone call with a quick assessment, or in severe crisis situation, a visit to the ER where we can actually assess you in person or via telepsych and do a more thorough assessment. But there are multiple avenues to seek help.
I know for me, when I admitted that I had an issue and I spoke to somebody, they initially suggested outpatient. But I knew for me personally, I would not follow through. So I knew that I had to go to inpatient. And
exactly.
It was the best thing I ever did. It really was.
Exactly. And that's one of the important points about treating addiction, is that you really want to meet the person where they're at. And if they're telling you they need inpatient, that means they know, they've been through this before, they've tried outpatient, it never worked for them. So, you just want to go where the patient is. And sometimes they might not be ready. Luckily, you were in a ready situation. You've tried it before. But sometimes we have the opposite problem. We feel that this person might need to come in inpatient. And they say, no, I don't want to do that. Their family might be worried about them, but they're not there yet. And
right.
That's kind of the tricky point, is where do you keep the connection? On one hand, you want this person to be connected to the system and try to work with them. On the other hand, you have all these concerns and the family's concerns that this is not going to work. And it just kind of, it's a little bit of a dialogue, so to speak.
Yeah, you just kind of feel each other out.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, so when I relapsed, when everything closed down, I quickly recognized that I needed help right away because I knew where this was going. But it was interesting because this was my first time relapsing. I learned very quickly that you don't start back over from the beginning. You actually pick up where you left off in your addiction. So I would like to talk to you about the biology, the science behind addiction, and the science behind relapsing.
Yes. So AA knew it way before us. 12 Steps knew it 50 years before neuroscience. AA always said, you pick up literally what you just said. You pick up where you left off. We know biologically now that addiction changes the brain in a way that is irreversible, meaning you stop your addiction, you control it. However, the changes that happened to your brain happened. They're irreversible. And any time you start using again, very quickly, you kind of go back to the same state you were in where you left it. And we have a lot of evidence that shows that on neurobiological studies and even just natural histories of people going through this horrible disease.
I find that so fascinating. They say the brain cells, they never forget. And coming off of a relapse not too long ago, it is absolutely true.
Exactly. There are pathways in the brain that change with addiction. So in every stage of addiction, it's like the brain is creating new pathways, these centers, the pleasure centers in the brain, as they communicate with the control centers of the brain, they kind of create new pathways, and these pathways are like highways in the mountain. They never go away. Once you start putting water in them, water is going to start flowing back in the same easy pathways.
That's interesting. For my journey, I started out as a, casual drinker, and then it became a pretty consistent drinker, having a cocktail at night. And at some point, I crossed this line into I needed to drink. Can you explain what happens when you kind of cross that line? What's happening inside?
Yeah. So developing an addiction disorder is a lot like having a perfect storm, so to speak. There are usually multiple things happening at the same time, and you need certain things to happen in a certain way. For example, To have a storm, you have to have a certain temperature of the water, certain temperature of the air, certain speed of the wind, so to speak, and all these things collide together, and you have the perfect storm, and it takes a life of its own. Same thing with addiction. Many times, it's a combination of a lot of things. First of all, it's gradual, like you mentioned. There's definitely a big genetic component to it. So biologically, the person might be already, their brain is prone to, if the circumstances allowed, they might develop a addiction syndrome. So now you have the genetic predisposition. Then you add to it the repeated exposure. And like I said, when you're using repeatedly, you're kind of creating these pathways in the brain. So little by little, you're making your tolerance higher and higher and higher, and these pathways are created in the brain. And then something happens, a stress happens, divorce, some difficulty at work, difficulty with a partner, blah, blah, blah. All these things kind of pile up on top of each other, and boom, you have the perfect storm, and now you have to stop this force of nature, so to speak.
That sounds pretty much accurate. So what's your approach at Sharp Mesa Vista Hospital and Sharp McDonald Center with addiction?
So we don't have one particular theory. We believe in 12 steps. We believe in cognitive therapy. We believe in using medications to help with cravings if needed, but that's not the main treatment. The whole idea is we want to provide a person with multiple tools and help them choose which tool or tools will work better for them. Because in some situation, you might need to start from a family session. Maybe there's so much tension in the family that is feeding this addiction, and without having that resolved first, you're never going to get anywhere. Sometimes you might be dealing with somebody who's severely depressed, and you have to treat the depression because the person is self-medicating. So you really don't want to be stuck with only one theory. You want to use all the tools and try to match the person to the right tool. And that's kind of the art of addiction treatment. There's no one silver bullet. Anybody who tells you this is the only method that is going to work, they have not worked with it. Maybe this method worked for them, but it doesn't mean it's going to work for everybody. So that's kind of the approach. We try to keep an open mind. Again, try to meet the person where they're at, see what is it that it's going on, what is keeping this cyclone going, and try to help them control it. And it might not happen initially. Sometimes it might take a couple of times before we kind of understand what's really going on.
Now, you said cognitive behavioral therapy. Can you explain what that is?
Sure. So cognitive behavioral therapy is a modality of therapy that initially was developed to treat depression and anxiety. It basically examines the person's thoughts and feelings and how they're connecting to each other, and try to help them when they monitor these thoughts to stop it. For example, somebody might say, oh, I had a bad grade today. I'm never going to be able to good in math. So I'm just using an example.
Right.
So this is kind of an example of black and white thinking. And with a therapist, you learn to kind of monitor, oh, here I'm doing it again. I'm doing black and white thinking. For example, for an addict, they might say, I'm never going to be able to quit, so might as well give up. That's a black and white thinking. So by pointing out that pattern to the person and help them monitor it and then stop it, you're basically doing cognitive behavioral therapy.
So it's just being aware of your own thoughts.
Exactly.
It's not always easy to do.
No.
And then you said something about medicated assisted treatment.
Yes. So there are situations where, for example, if a person continues to have a lot of cravings for alcohol, we have non-addictive medications, for example, naltrexone. This is a medication that works on cravings in the brain. The person can drink on it. Nothing really happens other than they just don't have the pleasure that they get from drinking. So if one of the struggles that the person is having is like, look, I'm having so much cravings, especially the first month or two, which are the hardest part of recovery, we might say, okay, for the first month or two, we're going to have to give you this medication, or we give you the option of using this medication to help you with your cravings. So that's kind of the idea. Keeping an open mind about some medications to use it, as long as you're working with a medical team that is addiction geared, not somebody who is going to give you an opiate, for example.
Right.
You know?
Isn't there another medication that can make you sick if you drink alcohol?
Yeah. So disulfiram or Anabuse is an older medication, FDA approved for alcoholism. That medicine, if you drink on it, it makes you sick. And sometimes we also use that resource. So maybe the person with their spouse might say, okay, I commit to you, spouse, I'm not going to drink. And I'm to kind of prove my commitment for the next month, I'm going to be taking Anabuse every day. And usually the spouse will give it. And many times we combine the two medicines together. So the Anabuse as the last resort and the naltrexone for cravings. Now, Anabuse, if you drink on it, you get violently ill. Naltrexone, if you drink on it, nothing happens.
Is there a certain criteria that you use to assess if someone has a drinking problem or a drug addiction?
Yes. There are multiple agencies that developed criteria, and they kind of are different in different ways. So, for example, the psychiatric community has what we call the DSM, the manual for diagnosis that we use. And this one has a long list of diagnoses. If you meet a certain number of these symptoms, you qualify to having a substance use disorder. So that's one way to look at it. It's just from the outside, you're looking at a set of symptoms. However, those of us who work with people afflicted with addiction every day, we know that this is not as simple as just a checklist. You really want to look at different things, functionality, their ability to work, their ability to keep a relationship. So, for example, the American Society of Addiction Medicine, ASAM, has criteria that are more dimensional, meaning on a biopsychosocial, what kind of difficulties you're having. In a housing situation, what kind of difficulties you're having. In a medical, what kind of difficulties you're having. What is your motivation? So you're looking at different dimensions and trying really to see the person from a 360-degree outlook. That gives you, in my opinion, better kind of view where the person is and what kind of services they need.
So if you think a loved one or a friend may have a problem, are there signs to look for?
Yes. So the biggest issue is the person starting to hide their behavior? They're ashamed of it. Shame is a big red flag. Are they starting to have difficulty with their functioning at work? Are they losing their temper? They're getting angry easily. Are they becoming depressed? Are they becoming suicidal? If they're using a stimulant, are they becoming psychotic? For example, hearing voices, seeing things. So these are really huge red flags that the family members should really be on the lookout for, and that's when you kind of want to intervene very quickly. But, you know, less severe ones, sleeping problems, the person is just not themselves, and you know that something is off, but you're not sure. Typically, family members, after a while, they kind of realize and they kind of know the pattern of the person, and hopefully they have enough of a relationship where they can say, hey, I'm starting to see the red flags here. I'm worried about you. We need to do something.
You don't need a referral to be seen at Sharp.
No. No referral is needed.
Okay. And what would you say your success rate is in recovery?
So our success rate, usually the way we, especially the McDonald's Center, the way we measure it is by calling patients who successfully finished a program, and we follow up with them at specific intervals. And I would say our success rate is about 60%, which is significantly high in addiction treatment.
Now, I know that that success rate goes up the longer someone remains sober.
Exactly.
So after a year, what would you say the success rate was?
I'll probably say around 55 to 60%. That's kind of the number I was referring to.
Oh, okay. Now, I know a lot of people don't really understand the science and biology behind addiction. And what would you say to that?
Well, I think the more we understand addiction and the biology of addiction, the more we are trying to be compassionate with a person. You want to help them not destroy their lives and at the same time try to be compassionate without being codependent. And I think that's the tricky part of treating addiction. People tend to go one extreme or the other. Either they're codependent, meaning they let the patient afflicted with addiction do whatever they want,
enabling them,
mm-hmm. or the other end of the spectrum where they become punitive and angry and frustrated. And we see it even within the medical community. Some doctors don't know how to say no when the patient keeps coming back and ask for opiates. And some doctors are just punitive and they kick the person out of their practice. Yeah, so the trick is to work with patients kind of in the middle. I always remind myself I have to work with people afflicted with addiction the same way I work with my teenager kids. I love them and I care about them. At the same time, I have to be watchful and pay attention, not because I don't trust them as humans, I just don't trust their disease. So you want to walk that fine line. You don't want to be too compassionate and codependent, and you don't want to be punitive, if that makes any sense.
It absolutely does. And you mentioned disease. A lot of people don't understand or don't necessarily believe that addiction is a disease. Can you explain real quickly what makes it a disease, or why is it called a disease?
Sure. So again, as I mentioned before, we have a lot of evidence now. In the last 10 years, we have a lot of studies that show the changes in the brain. The brain of people with addiction is different than a brain of a person who does not have addiction. We know that. It's proven. There is a genetic predisposition. There are chemical changes that happen in the brain. There is a biological, even structural changes that happen in the brain the more the addiction is progressed. So it's a lot like any other disease. It's just for some reason it is hard for us to believe that it is, because it's the part of the brain that is responsible for pleasure, and we feel like we need to be in control of that, which some of us are able to, but not everybody. If it was the thinking brain, for example, patients with dementia, we don't blame them that they have a disorder of the brain. If they have Parkinson's, we don't blame them that it's they're causing the Parkinson's. But for some reason, society always blamed addiction on the person who's afflicted with the disorder.
That's interesting. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Nicholas, for joining the show today. I really appreciate it.
Same here. And good luck with your journey.
Thank you. That concludes another edition of Living Better in San Diego. The opinions expressed on Living Better in San Diego do not necessarily reflect the opinions and views of the staff and management of the Entercom San Diego radio stations. Episodes of Living Better in San Diego are available on the station's website. I'm Amber Rainey. Have a great week.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.